This building podcast is brought to you by Fenwick Elliott, the construction and energy law specialist. To find out more, go to www.fenwickelliott.com. Hello and welcome back to a brand new series of building podcasts. I'm your host, Jamie Harris, Building's digital editor. On today's episode, we head to Chernobyl, where a £1.5 billion steel arch is being constructed over the nuclear reactor damage during the catastrophic disaster in 1986.
And what they were having to do was they just had a crew of drillers. One guy would run in, he'd drill for 15 minutes, he'd run out and the next guy would come in because they would max out their daily dose rate that way.
Also coming up, the Hackett Report has laid out steps to improve safety in the wake of Grenfell. Building Live Club's conference last week focused on how these recommendations should become reality.
Well, now it's above 18 metres, we've got 500 buildings. How on earth are we going to find the resource and the money just to deliver this effectively?
That's a taste of what's to come in this episode. Stick around. Welcome back to Building Podcasts. It's very good to be back with you for the next 5 weeks. We've got some excellent guests and stories lined up. But first up today.
So first of all, you need to understand how I got over here.
Right.
This is Victor. He works on the site of the worst ever nuclear disaster.
So 10 years I've worked in the very same nuclear power plant in a city called Kurchatov. This is Kursk nuclear power plant.
It's been 33 years since the fateful Chernobyl disaster in the Ukraine, and work is still underway to contain radioactivity at the site, including the delicate construction of a steel arch over the damaged reactor. Building's intrepid reporter Will Ng headed over to the Ukraine to speak to the people overseeing the operation.
And in 1987, I was sent over here to liquidate the consequences of the arch, and I was reinstalling and fixing all the problems in unit number 3.
С 96-го года в качестве подрядчика занимался многими проектами, которые были уже на объекте укрытия.
In 1996 I've started working as a contractor on various projects that were performed on site that time.
Так что поэтому как бы как в этом месте работать? Это половина моей жизни.
So to your question, how I'm working over here and how it feels to work over here. I've spent half of my life over here.
Hi.
Поэтому так что вот на стороне особенно нигде больше не работал.
So basically this is like my home. I have not worked in some major areas somewhere aside of over here. This is the major project of my life.
Поэтому как бы это, наверное, дело привычки. Вот привыкаешь к месту, привыкаешь к людям, которые тебя окружают, и все становится комфортно.
I think that this is just a thing of a habit to what you get used to, because you are getting used to a place where you work, you're getting used to people who you work with, and everything becomes like at home.
So, Will, you went to Chernobyl and survived to tell the tale. First impressions, what does a 1,000 square mile area, which has been uninhabited and restricted from public access for 33 years, I mean, what does that look and feel like?
Very strange, honestly. So you first arrive, you're sort of on quite fairly quiet road, you've gone north of Kiev, and so you arrive and you get to a military checkpoint. And you need to have the right papers to get through. So I didn't do any of that. My host has all arranged that. But the Ukrainian sort of security apparatus had already processed me, so I had the right piece of paper, hand over my passport, and then you go through the barrier, and then you're in. That's the 30-kilometre exclusion zone. And then after that, it's normal for a bit. So it's just, it's very sort of dense forests. And it does look like it's been untouched for ages. And occasionally you sort of see out over sort of fields but with sort of large forests all around. And I went in spring, obviously, so very green. And I saw some horses, like by the road, which is mad. And a bit later, I saw some mooses as well, or a single moose rather. So that's very, very strange. And then you start to see old buildings that have been abandoned, houses basically, not very big, but just one after the other along the road, and they sort of stretch back into the forest. And that's very strange, because I haven't really ever seen anything like it. And, you know, people used to live there. So then there's that. And then after a while, it sort of gets a bit less densely forested, and you start to see the actual nuclear power plant itself.
Sort of in the distance.
Yeah, so actually almost one of the first things you see is this giant concrete, not quite a dome, but kind of lens shape. And that was used as an early warning system by the Soviets. And then you have Reactor 5 and Reactor 6. Now, they were never finished, but this sort of enormous kind of rusty cuboid and several cranes, you know, maybe five or six cranes, completely decrepit, almost a bit like spidery on the skyline, that are just sort of, you know, they're enormous, these things. They're hanging up there in front of you. And then you sort of turn the corner a bit, and that's when you see new safe confinement, which I imagine we'll get onto. But essentially, it's massive sort of silver dome or silver arch.
I imagine it's just probably nothing like you imagined before you went.
It's quite extraordinary going in there, and you've got the kind of nervousness about what it's like to be in, you know, the site of this horrific disaster that still has much higher, you know, levels of background radiation than we have, say, in London. You know, it's not like all nuclear suits everywhere you go. It's more like you can't. So, you know, the nuclear contamination back in 1986 was thrown up out of the reactor when it exploded. But now it's sort of faded down into the land. So it's in the soil rather than on the topsoil. So mushrooms, for example, all around that region are thought to be quite dangerous to consume because they will have grown through the radioactive soil. So it's fine to be on the roads, but still today, if I went near the grass or the sand, I was told by the people who I was with, you know, very sternly, not to go on that, because you just don't know where there are bits of contaminants and where they may be. And most of these abandoned houses as well, I'm sure if you look on YouTube, you can see that people have been in some of them, but it's not really safe because you're never quite sure when you're going to wander on to a particularly sort of strong bit of contamination.
And of course, you know, there's been a lot of people working on this site and working to sort of, the new safe containment unit, is that
confinement.
Right? Confinement. Yeah. New safe confinement unit, which has been in construction for some years now. And there's been obviously hundreds, maybe even thousands of people who have been working on this site. And you spoke to quite a few of them. I mean, what did they tell you about what it's like to work there?
That's true. I mean, it was thousands at its peak. But yeah, it depends. I mean, it's very international there, actually. There are people from the UK, from Australia, from America. There are lots of different firms working on it. You know, the main contractor on the new safe confinement part of it is a JV between Vinci and Bouygues. But then you have Bechtel leading the project manager for that. I was with Thomas and Adamson, who were the monitoring consultant for the client. And then elsewhere you have Wood working on it and another American firm, Holtec. So there are lots of different, but there are also, I should add, lots of Ukrainians that have worked there, either for the power plant itself or as subcontractors or for those firms. What's it like? I don't think you can generalise too much. I mean, I think if you've worked there for a long time, and some of the people have worked there for decades, then it's quite normal. It's just where they work. But I think it's quite difficult. It's very remote. And obviously you can't just go for long walks. So I think a lot of the foreign firms have policies whereby, you know, staff will leave every 6 weeks, either to go back to Kiev or, you know, see their families.
So how far is it from Kiev? You said you drove up there.
Yeah, so it's about 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Okay, okay.
So some people do live within the exclusion zone. And some of the blocks, the tower blocks that were, well, not quite tower blocks, but sort of the mass apartment blocks have been renovated and made safe for some of the construction workers.
Wow, okay. So, of course, we heard from Victor earlier on, and it's quite interesting, isn't it, the impact that, you know, A, this disaster, and then obviously all the work that's being done is having on people who have lived and experienced it locally. So perhaps, you know, people who grew up near the exclusion zone or grew up in Kiev or, you know, lived nearby, it's... did you get a sense for, you know, just the kind of impact it's had on people's lives there?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense it's hard because all the sort of ultra-local people left and went to live in Kiev. And by all accounts, they were treated relatively well by the Soviet state, but less well by, you know, the locals, who are often quite jealous and they got preferential access to, you know, good housing and stuff like that. So I think in the schools, a lot of the children were bullied and had an awful time. But, you know, at the same time, these families weren't sort of destitute. One of the people I spoke to was Irina. She is 31 or 32, and she's worked in Chernobyl for about 10 years, so most of her working life. And she says she's always been fascinated by it. Her dad used to work at the plant in a kind of workshop. And she found out about it, obviously, from a very young age. She was born a couple of years after it took place. So I think she says, I think partially, as she's younger and she speaks much better English than most people on site, she takes people around a lot. And so through that lens, she's sort of forced to think about it. But also with the family connection, you know, she says being on site, she does think about it most days. And she's also really obsessed by all the TV series and the books. And, you know, she knows which ones are good and which ones aren't rubbish. So she's quite interested in that sort of legacy.
Well, my father used to work over here. And I was always curious, what is that creature, Chernobyl? I always wondered, I always wanted to have a look, and I actually had not a single idea that one day I would be working over here.
Where are you from?
I'm from Ukraine.
Right. Are you from around here?
From Slavutich, well, right, I'm from Kyiv.
Right, okay.
Both.
What did your father do?
He used to work for repair and deconstruction shop, so he was mainly repairing different type of equipment, cranes, basically.
Right, around Chernobyl?
Yeah, around Chernobyl, everywhere, mainly inside the units. It's, you know, it's such a story, it's not a story for sure, accident, period of the life,
yeah.
Everyone knows about it. So at what age exactly? No, I don't remember, I can't tell you, but since my childhood.
Compare that to a man like Victor that was, you know, to be honest, very blasé about it all. I say to Victor, look, you were here a couple of years after, you know, the world's worst nuclear disaster. It was a travesty. On what kind of scale, you know, we don't really know. It's statistically very hard to work out. But he's like, yes, well, you know, I've been working here for decades now, and I worked on nuclear plants before that, and it's just work, and I sort of get on with the job, so now I don't think about it. So that is interesting. But they do have more memorials on site still. You know, there are sort of areas where commemoration happens, and every year a ceremony will take place. So
talk us through your day at Chernobyl. Obviously, you told us about, you know, the drive up there and you went to go and see the reactor site itself, and
it's very weird being on site that there are dogs lying around, like everywhere, just wild dogs, I suppose, but they would have been domesticated, you know, in the 80s and before that, and they sometimes come up to you and you sort of have to wander away quite quickly. But mostly they're just very sleepy and they just sort of sit. And some of them do look a bit puffy in the face, a bit red-eyed, certainly quite like haggard. So that's very strange, just having dogs on site. I mean, obviously it would be completely disallowed in the UK.
Okay.
And then we get to new safe confinement. And there, I should say there are countless layers of not only security and seeing your passport, but also you have to sort of go through these scanners or not scanners. You put your hands and sort of your face up to the thing and they detect radio contamination that you might have. So there are lots of layers of checking you're not radio contaminated. And they do take safety quite seriously.
Of course.
I dared sort of think about eating a sandwich outdoors in the open, but that was a big no-no,
okay,
I'm told. So anyway, eventually you do get into this arch and you go through a sort of control centre where they control all the bits of it. And the whole point of this arch basically is that the sarcophagus, which is the structure they put around the exploded reactor to stop it firing out more contamination, that is also sort of very frail. And obviously if it collapses, you have more sort of dust and contaminants that could come out. So it's really to cover it. And now they will, you know, dismantle it and make sure it's all safe. So, yeah, just very strange. Strange to be in the sort of control room of this. And then very strange to see the covered reactor itself and, you know, think it's where the firefighters on... you know, on that night in April 1986, were sort of the first responders. And of course they, you know, all died sort of months later.
Mm.
On site itself, you're sort of so blown away by this enormous, I mean, really enormous arch, and the quite amazing engineering feat that it is, that you're almost like not thinking about the disaster in the same way. It's very old though.
Yeah, yeah.
So on my day walking around, I was with Colin Ross from Thomas & Adamson, and one of the many, actually, interesting people I spoke to was Oscar McNeil. He was head of the project management unit, so he works for Bechtel, but he's sort of heading that up.
And when I came out here, I thought this project was just to build a big dumb steel arch. I didn't know until I got here how sophisticated that thing is in terms of the systems that are in it.
Wow, and do you remember the Chernobyl accident at the
mm-hmm.
time?
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like coming here 30 years later or whatever, 27?
You know, it's such a project on the international stage. I mean, I remember when the accident happened. I don't think I really knew much about the details of it, but I knew that what it had done was spread contamination over most of Europe and into Russia. A lot of concern that this object shelter that was built over the reactor right after the accident mm-hmm. was unstable. And that had a lot to do with the reason for putting this arch structure over it, was in case this thing collapsed.
Yeah.
And the reason that it was shaky was that when they built it, you know, it was hot. You know, they couldn't get people in there close enough to do normal construction.
How long would they normally be able to work for before having to be...
Well, it depended on where they were working. We had places where literally the worker could not be there more than 15 minutes.
Right.
So when Navarca was trying to, they had some anchors they had to install on the far end of the arch, and they had to drill down into an area to make their connections. And what they were having to do was they just had a crew of drillers, you know, and one guy would run in, he'd drill for 15 minutes, he'd run out and the next guy would come in and continue drilling. And because they would max out their daily dose rate that way.
Do you think about the people that died here much? I mean, you mentioned only sort of finding out about all the death when you came here. Do you think it... how often do you think about it? Do you think about it every day?
No. It's something that, you know, is in the back of my mind. It's not something that I dwell on.
Yeah.
There are a lot of reminders around here. They call the people who came in to put out the fires, they call them liquidators. Mm. And so there's a, various memorial ceremonies at particular times, and there's a wall in Slavutich that's got pictures of all the 30, I think it was 31, that died in the immediate explosion and fire. But, it was interesting because when we would walk around on inspections, people would actually put flowers mm-hmm. at that memorial. So, the Ukrainians are kind of sentimental that way. This was a big deal to them and still is in a lot of ways. It still is to the world community, I think.
And you can read Will's feature in full at building.co.uk. Moving on, this month the government launched its consultation on how to implement Dame Judith Hackett's recommendations on building regulations and fire safety, prompting Building to dedicate its first Building Live Club event last week to the issues and questions raised in the 200-page document. The consultation closes after 8 weeks on the 31st of July, and it proposes wide-ranging reform, including plans for a new building safety regulator and a new inspection regime at three stages known as gateways in a project. The event was attended by over 100 people and consisted of two panel debates featuring a range of experts and specialists, most of whom have been working with the government since the Grenfell disaster 2 years ago. Let's take a listen to some of that debate. Here's Andrew Meller, partner at PRP, Rachel Rees, partner at Trowers and Hamlins, but first up, Jim Martin, Executive Chairman of Martin Arnold.
I employed four clerks of works. We didn't call them clerks of works, we called them quality control inspectors. Today, I employ 16, and they're all flat out busy, believe me. So straight away, the early reaction from all of our clients, predominantly housing associations, local authorities, and other large stock holders, we were doing fire risk assessments, morning, noon, and night. We were working weekends, we were working, as long as it was light, we were doing fire risk assessments. We've moved on now much more to the quality function, particularly as the remedial work starts to occur. We are seeing at the moment, I don't want to be the harbinger of doom, but we are seeing the tip of the iceberg. This problem runs a lot deeper than the wrong cladding, believe me. So, unlike Graham, when I saw that fire at Grenfell, I felt guilty, but I wasn't surprised. And everything that's come out in the public inquiry so far, in the media, nothing has surprised me at all. And the reason is because I go back to Lackenall. I go back to Lackenall House, and I'll say again how people avoided going to prison over what happened at Lackenall House still continues to amaze me. I think if it were the other way around and Lackenall followed Grenfell, then people would be going to prison.
I've been working on this Hackett process for the last 12 months with MHCLG and my team and other consultants. Our work's in Annex A. It's the analytical, technical and financial aspects of the impacts of this process. And I guess the surprise in a consultation document for most people, this relates to buildings above 18 metres, when Dame Hackett said we should start with buildings above 30 metres. So it brings a lot more buildings into play, both existing buildings and new buildings. Some of our clients are saying, well, we've got 100 buildings over 30 metres, we've got to do this safety case and digital record, but now it's above 18 metres, we've got 500 buildings. How on earth are we going to find the resource and the money just to deliver this effectively? So I think it's key things I've picked out which are relate to my business as an architect and my company effectively. And the first is the principal designer role. So this is not a role as we know under CDM, this is wider arching than this. This is a real responsible duty holder role. We have to co-sign at the end of the project before it's occupied to say that building is absolutely compliant with the building regulations. Well, if we take on that role under design and build, we hardly ever go to site. So suddenly, our PR insurers, if they're going to insure us to do this role, will want us to go to site because they want us to inspect the buildings to make sure that they're being as built as per the drawing information. And of course, that principal designer is not just looking at the architectural aspects, they're looking at the M&E aspects, they're looking at the structural aspects as well. So it's not an individual, it's a multi-skilled team effectively that's got to be put in place to deliver that role. So it comes with some risk.
We've been ploughing through the 192 pages at Trowers, and we've got a team of 15 lawyers looking at it because we're looking at it from housing associations and local authorities, but also we've got lots of developer clients and lots of clients that will end up being building safety managers as well, and each of those groups are impacted very differently. So today I have my construction and my procurement hat on, and first of all I thought I'd pick up about key themes that I think from a construction point of view are going to be quite challenging. We've talked about the concept of the duty holder today, and that's one of the changes from the discussions to the consultation is that we're now going to have a duty holder during the design and construction phase and an accountable person during the occupation phase. And for our housing association clients, if they are buying a couple of Section 106 units in a high-risk residential building, where is the liability going to lie between the duty holder and the accountable person, which is unlikely to be them? And in the face of a signed-off fire safety certificate, as a purchaser of a unit or two or three in a tower block, what are they going to have to look for in terms of if something happened, a catastrophic event happened whilst they're in occupation, who is liable? Because at the moment we would go back to the principal designer or the contractor. And is that going to be the case? Or is the developer as duty holder still going to have a residual liability under the new regulatory regime? But the consultation to us at the moment seems to talk about duties to enforce and not be backed up by that many powers. And it seems to me that the ability to implement these obligations are at odds with this enduring right for a lessee or a tenant to enjoy or have quiet enjoyment of their flat. So seems to be a tension running throughout the consultation between a tenant's rights. There's a very proactive communication and engagement strategy that's going to have to put in place through the occupation. But there doesn't seem to be many responsibilities on the tenants. And I understand coming up to the second anniversary that this maybe not be the time, or as MHCLG would say, we don't have the optics to really push onto tenants a rigorous set of obligations. But there must be a two-way relationship.
That was a short clip of what you missed at the Building Live Club event titled Implementing the Hackett Review, Next Steps Forward. To read more views and news from last week's Building Live Club event, head to building.co.uk. And there's still time to secure your place at the next Building Live Club event, which is set to focus on how industry can make the most out of digital at what is a crucial time for the industry. Head to building-live.co.uk to find out more and to grab your ticket. Well, that's it for this week's Building Podcast, which was brought to you by Fenwick Elliott, the Construction and Energy Law Specialists. To find out more, go to www.fenwickelliott.com. As ever, please do let us know your thoughts and feedback on these podcasts by leaving a review on iTunes or by emailing building@building.co.uk. Don't forget, you can listen back to our archive of podcast episodes from this series and before by going to building.co.uk/podcasts. Or by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks once again for listening. I've been Jamie Harris. Until next time.